Good evening and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, to an all-English prom tonight, a feast of melody and emotion, served up by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by their much-loved conductor laureate, Tadaaki Otaka, a noted champion of British music. We have two works featuring wonderful bass baritone Jonathan Limalu. We have John Ireland's These Things Shall Be and Walton's mighty oratorio Belshazzar's Feast. We're continuing this season's celebration of Delius with his walk to the Paradise Garden. But we're going to start the programme this evening with Vaughan Williams's Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis. So well known and well loved today, it's hard to believe it was considered really rather difficult when it was first performed in Gloucester Cathedral as part of the 1910 Three Choirs Festival. Well, I'm joined here in the BBC Radio 3 box by Adrian Partington, who's chorus master of the BBC National Chorus of Wales and is the director of music at Gloucester Cathedral, and so knows better than anyone that, of course, the acoustic is the biggest player in this next piece, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it was clearly written with our wonderful acoustic in mind at Gloucester Cathedral, although the Albert Hall has its own very special acoustic, and the way that Tadaaki Otaka has placed the string forces will mean that it's going to be not dissimilar to how it was done at Gloucester Cathedral in 1910.
So what has he done? What are we going to hear?
Well, we're going to hear the smallest string ensemble. It's going to be right up in the gods. I don't know what the highest gallery is called here, but it's right up high. And then the middle-sized ensemble is actually on the stage and strategically placed. So there's three very different sounds.
Well, let's talk about those sounds, because, of course, Vaughan Williams was looking back to the Elizabethan age, but it actually feels very modern as well, and it was very influential, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I mean, my own composition teacher, Herbert Howells, was present at the first performance in 1910, and he found it stunning, couldn't sleep for two nights because it was so exciting.
Really?
The sounds that he liked were the sudden changes of key, as well as that, the spacing of the chords. And the notion of these three different ensembles combining, contrasting, in the, as I say, that matchless acoustic of Gloucester Cathedral. Very modern, but very old as well.
And of course, Vaughan Williams was a good organist, wasn't he? So he knew what he was doing, writing for organ.
I think he was an organist. His feet were too big to play the organ. I don't wish to be offensive, but he did have very large feet and had difficulty in playing accurately on the pedals.
But can you hear that influence in the writing?
I can, because it's like playing the main string ensemble is like the great manual, the smallest ensemble is like the swell manual, and the little ensemble is like the choir manual. It's like going from one manual to another.
And your organ teacher is actually in the audience. You just spotted him, haven't you? So,
yes.
You know, these fascinating
Absolutely.
Organ facts that we're hearing. He'll be very chuffed when he listens back on the iPlayer, as I trust he does.
Well, he may do, although I'm not sure how good he is with technology.
Actually, it's a good point for me to mention to people listening at home that if you'd like to read a little bit more about tonight's programme, you can see the concert notes on the Radio 3 website. And as I've already said, you can, of course, listen again to this prom should you enjoy it so much you want to experience it again for at least 7 days, up to 7 days on the Radio 3 website. So we have a packed hall and we have a packed stage because we have the chorus we've already talked about, the BBC National Chorus of Wales, and indeed they're joined by the BBC Symphony Chorus. But now, coming to the stage, joining the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, is their much-loved conductor, Tadaaki Otaka, to conduct Vaughan Williams's Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis.
Thank you.
Vaughan Williams's Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis, performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by their conductor laureate Tadaaki Otaka. And he's thanking the offstage string ensemble up in the gallery, as well as the string orchestra on stage. But he also brought to their feet the four principals, the four leaders of the sections: leader Leslie Hatfield, principal second violinist Naomi Harris, principal viola player Gordon Frust, and principal cellist John Center. Wonderful, wonderful performance, I felt, and my colleague Adrian Partington is still with me here in the Radio 3 box. How did you feel that piece worked here in the Royal Albert Hall?
I thought it was utterly transporting, really, really beautiful, as beautiful as I've ever heard it. And the large distance between the small chamber group up at the top there and the main orchestra was not noticeable. They coordinated it brilliantly. Who's inspired to put them up there.
The audience here are absolutely rapt, and I must say, it doesn't matter how many times I hear that piece of music, I'm always on the verge of tears.
I know, it is so beautiful. It's because it feels so ancient and yet so new at the same time. It is a curious and affecting mixture.
Well, we have a short amount of break, if you like, a small amount of time to fill now, because of course that string orchestra up in the gallery, we've got to get back down onto the stage, so we have to load a double bass and some cellos and violins etc. into the goods lift.
Absolutely.
At the Royal Albert Hall. Keep our fingers crossed all is working well and that there are people pulling the pulleys and pressing the levers, and they will be back on stage in a few minutes. But it gives us an opportunity, Adrian, to talk about the next work, which is a work by John Ireland, Cheshire boy, student of Charles Villiers Stanford, who actually became famous overnight in 1917 with his second violin sonata, but I think perhaps he's best known now for his church music. I think that's certainly the case in your experience,
yes,
isn't it? You program
yes.
a lot of his work at Gloucester.
Well, there isn't very much of it really, but what there is, we do. We do, of course, the famous anthem that all choirs do, Greater Love Hath No Man, which is very beautiful, written in memory of his friends that had died in the First World War, and it's all about the laying down of life for one's friends. Very, very beautiful.
So theme, his sort of theme of pacifism and bringing nations together is a theme which is we're going to hear in the work that is going to be performed tonight, which is a BBC commission for a special concert to mark the coronation of King George VI. And John Ireland set the text, written by John Addington Symonds. It's a piece called These Things Shall Be. Can you tell us any more about that poem?
Well, I can. I mean, it's a poem by this slightly eccentric Victorian who had very, very modern views about all sorts of aspects of life, about love and about family and about sexuality. But this piece is mostly, as you say, about pacifism. It's a very optimistic piece, but there's a sadness behind it as well, I think, because he talks often about the word freedom. And we know that in his personal life he felt terribly frustrated for one reason or another. And died rather an unhappy man. So there is something more than appears.
And well, I mentioned it was a BBC commission, and at the time apparently he said to the then head of music at the BBC that he felt that the words represented the BBC motto, which was Nations or Speak Peace Unto Nation. And of course it was written in 1937, this piece of music, when
well, indeed,
we all know what was brewing.
Absolutely. But I think Ireland had a great deal of sympathy for the world outlook of Symonds, because he was also very unhappy and very, very private man. So these words meant a lot. And of course, Ireland had already set these words as a straight hymn tune before he attempted what is his second biggest composition after the piano concerto.
Yes, let's talk about that piano concerto, because for a long time it was a real pot boiler. Everybody knew it, everybody loved it. I believe it was played 21 times in 29 years here at the Proms.
Well, it was certainly when I was growing up, it was my father's favourite piece of music. I'm sorry that it's not performed more often, because it is seriously beautiful.
Well, John Ireland, perhaps a neglected composer, but not tonight, because here coming onto stage is the conductor tonight, Tadaaki Otaka, with bass baritone Jonathan Lemalu, who's going to be singing one verse of this particular poem, a very positive and uplifting verse as well, one he described as the let's all have a hug verse. So here, please enjoy John Ireland's These Things Shall Be.
Say Oh! and with land, inland, inland, inland shall live as comrades free. Oh!
John Ireland's These Things Shall Be, performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, with the BBC National Chorus of Wales and the BBC Symphony Chorus, and bass baritone Jonathan Namalu singing the solo there, all under the benign baton of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales conductor Tadaki Otaka. And Adrian, what did you make of that?
Well, I don't want to seem immodest, but I was very pleased with the chorus's contribution.
As their chorus master, you're allowed to crow a little.
Well,
I will allow
you.
That. No, they're doing very fine voice, I thought.
I made a special point of listening carefully to the words to see if there were any that I didn't understand, and I think they were all there.
For people who haven't heard much of John Ireland's work, it was a very interesting piece, and mostly very beautiful, very lyrical, but occasional moments of almost quite sinister sound worlds, especially towards the end.
Well, it's a piece that's kind of looking to the future, isn't it? It's consciously looking to the future, and of course, nobody knows really what the future holds for them. So there is that undercurrent of discomfort, I'd say, which I tried to talk about in the poem as well earlier on. It's yes, it seems quite happy and quite positive, but it isn't completely.
Yes,
because neither composer nor poet were happy men.
Well, as you can probably tell if you're listening at home, you can hear the happy sound of people getting up and leaving for the interval and making their way to the bar. It is time for the interval. In part two of tonight's run, we have Walton's mighty Belshazzar's feast, and we have Delius's walk to the Paradise Garden. And we're going to pick up that garden reference during the interval now, as the gardening writer and broadcaster Anna Pavord takes the opportunity to celebrate one of her great heroes, the largely forgotten 16th century father of English botany, William Turner. Anna's long been a fan of Turner, but her interest was recently rekindled by a curious story of lost and found at the church where William and his son Peter are both buried.
I'm standing in the churchyard of St Olave's, just round the corner from Fenchurch Street Station in the City of London. With the Olympics going on all around, this little garden provides an unexpected and welcome sanctuary. And the church itself is a 15th century jewel. Here, just by the church porch, I'm looking at a board that lists the prominent people connected with the place. Samuel Pepys, Sir James Dean, a merchant adventurer, Sir Andrew Rickard, chairman of the East India Company. Oddly, though, there's no mention of my particular hero, who in the middle of the 16th century walked to worship here from his house at Crutched Friars. This was William Turner, father of English botany, though the word botany hadn't been invented when he wrote his New Herbal, the first plant book ever to be written in English. That book, published in three parts in the middle of the 16th century, was a landmark, but was written in the most difficult circumstances imaginable, while Turner was in exile, permanently on the move. Why? From Morpeth, where he'd been born in 1508, Turner had gone up to Cambridge, where he fell in with a group of reformers who met regularly at the White Horse Inn to argue about religion. Among them were Nicholas Ridley, who taught Turner Greek, and Hugh Latimer, whose brilliant sermons made Cambridge a pioneering centre of the Reformation in England. Like Latimer, Turner believed passionately in justice and reason. Like Latimer, he argued furiously against the superstition and nepotism of the Catholic Church. That was his problem. He was a staunch Protestant at a time when it was more politic not to be. In 1540, unable to preach the doctrines he so passionately believed in, he fled to Calais and did not return to England until Henry VIII had died. During that seven-year exile, sustained by generous gifts from Ridley, he wanders through France and into Italy. He goes to Venice, where he later writes of seeing the pink-flowered tamarisk for the first time. He sends plants from Brabant to his friends John Rich and Hugh Morgan, both apothecaries and keen plantsmen, here in the city of London. And he works on his herbal. By the time he returned to England, he could boast, though he didn't, that no other Englishman of the age had seen so many different plants growing in so many different places. Turner had hoped that on his return to England he could lead a more settled life with time to devote to his major work. Anxiously, he tried for the placement in the church he felt he now deserved. His children, he says, have been fed so long with hope that they are very lean. I would fain have them fatter, if it were possible. Finally, he was awarded the Deanery of Wells, though he had problems getting the previous incumbent evicted. It's not the money he cares about, as much as a resting place for me and my poor Childer. There were now three of these Childer, including his son Peter, born while Turner was in exile. Despite the poverty, the lack of anywhere to lay his books, Turner did manage in 1551 to deliver that first part of his Herbal to his London printer. That was Stephen Meerdman. He'd written it not in Latin, as most plant books were at that time, but in English, hoping that by this means he could spread his knowledge to the widest possible public. But that aim didn't have the desired effect. Of the 3 million people living in Britain at the time, perhaps 500,000 could read. But anyone who could read read Latin as easily as they could read English. And the fact that Turner's most important book was written in English meant that it never found an audience on the continent, where Latin was the universal language, the Esperanto of the age. He was also unlucky in his timing. After only 6 years on the throne, Edward was succeeded by his Catholic half-sister Mary, so once again, Turner found himself on the wrong side of the religious divide and once again had to leave England in a hurry. For the second time, all his books were banned, and that too greatly diminished his chances of finding an audience for his exceptional, pioneering book. Poor Turner. But perhaps his moment has finally arrived. I last came into this church on a hot summer's day in 2008, carrying a posy of West Country flowers for Turner. It was the 500th anniversary of his birth, and I felt the occasion demanded a little celebration. A great deal of fuss had been made the previous year over the tercentenary of the Swedish plantsman Linnaeus's birth. Turner, in my mind, was the greater man. I knew that Turner's wife had put up a memorial to him inside St. Olaf's. But where was it? I tiptoed past someone practicing a Schubert sonata on a grand piano set in front of the altar. Facing each other across the chancel were the wonderfully preposterous busts of Rickard and Pepys, who worshipped at St. Olaf's and was buried here. Finally, in a far corner, I found the small, closely lettered alabaster tablet that commemorates my hero. Today, of course, I know exactly where to find it, and I'm here with Phil Manning, who manages affairs at this church. Phil, I do confess that I was expecting something rather grander for Turner, but it reminded me very much of a Victorian mourning card, that very heavy black border around a very plain inside.
Yes, it's very understated, isn't it? But it is, if one looks at it, quite eloquent about Turner and his achievements and his interests, emphasising medicine and theology as the twin poles around which his scholarship and activity revolved.
Why did you think his wife mentioned in any way at all his books, particularly, of course, the one I'm interested in is The New Herbal, but he wrote on wine, he wrote on fishes, he wrote on all sorts of other things. He was a terrific author in English at that time.
Absolutely, very prolific. There's no mention of writing specifically, only of his scholarship. Maybe she was relying on what people already knew about him because he was quite prominent. But since his time, knowledge about him has rather dropped below public notice.
Now, I didn't know when I first visited that opposite William Turner's memorial, there was also once a bust commemorating his son Peter. But rather an extraordinary story has been unfolding around this bust, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Here we were getting very interested in William when out of the blue in April 2010 I received a phone call from a curator at the Museum of London, and somebody else had alerted him to the fact that this bust had come up in a public auction.
And when was it lost then? I mean, what happened?
We conclude that it must have been lost in the war when this church suffered two direct hits in 1941. One ploughed into the floor, the other exploded and did the major damage, and then there were a bomb a few months later that brought the bells down in a heap of molten metal. So this church was devastated.
And so it sort of just disappeared at that stage?
It was lost in the fog of war, that's all we can conclude.
So, I mean, I'm sure it's a very complicated affair, but you get this phone call, you realise that Peter is not alive and well, but, you know, is still around. What's the process then that you have to go through to actually get him back where he belongs in St Olaf's?
Well, in this case, we were able very quickly to speak to the Art Loss Register, who really could not have been more helpful. And the Art Loss Register proceeded to negotiate, initially through the auctioneers, and then made contact with the man who owned the bust, who gave it back to us. To cut quite a long story very short.
I bet it was a long story.
Yes.
And Peter had gone abroad.
Peter had been to the Low Countries in the meantime. Yes, rather like his father.
Exactly. Rather ironic.
Yes. Yes, he'd had his own period of exile.
Yes. Well, he's not back here on the wall yet. Where is he at the moment?
At the moment, he's within the parish with our very good friends, the Clothworkers' Company. They very kindly agreed to store the bust in their secure vault until we could put him safely back on the wall.
We've walked down the street, not far, to the magnificent premises of the Cloth Workers' Company. We've been joined by Jim Harris, who is the Caroline Villers Research Fellow at the Courtauld Institute and a specialist in painted sculpture. Jim, you've got a special interest in this bust, haven't you, because you worship at St Olaf's and you'd very much like to see it back in its proper place.
I would. I've been undertaking some research on the whole group of monuments in St Olaf's and looking at their painted surfaces and whether there is anything that we can tell about their histories from the paint that's been left on them over time. And Peter Turner's a very interesting and important object in relation to that group.
Well, he's sitting on the floor at the moment, covered in a blanket. Are you going to sort of lift the blanket and let us see?
I will.
One,
reveal
two, three.
His,
yes.
I will reveal his slightly alarming physiognomy
to
you.
I'm prepared.
Ooh. There we are.
Yes, the eyes, they're very staring, aren't they?
He is very staring. Oliver Ross, our rector, often wonders whether he might have had a slight thyroid problem. But it's hard to tell. He's certainly a very distinctive portrait. As a piece of sculpture, he's probably not in the same league as some of the other monuments at St Olaf's, but as a representation of who this person was, I think he's really remarkable. The way in which his clothing is defined is also a very good quality. He's not, unlike some of the other monuments at St Olaf's, distinguished by armour, because he's not a knight. He doesn't wear aldermanic robes like some of his colleagues. But he has the dress of a prosperous professional gentleman of the city in the early part of the 17th century.
The colour is fascinating, isn't it? Somehow I was expecting, well, when I think of a bust, I just think of stone or alabaster or marble.
He's much more thoroughly painted than we sometimes expect alabaster figures to be. So he has this red tunic with a black surcoat over it with very elaborate buttons and buttonholes. His buttons down his surcoat are gilded once upon a time, although that gilding has been painted over. His flesh tones are rendered realistically in pink and pale white colours, and he has a very fine kind of shovel-cut beard and a ruff, which is painted white. His eyes are picked out with dark pupils, and his hair is brown underneath a kind of scholar's cap which covers his skull.
Well, having seen it, it sort of just makes it all the more ridiculous to me somehow that here's this amazingly important-looking thing for the man who actually wasn't half what his father, William Turner, was.
Well, it's an interesting point. Certainly, what we know of William was that he didn't like people who made the most of their position for financial gain, and that his interest really was in his study. Peter, coming to London, making his name as a physician at Barts, training in Europe, probably did have a slightly more self-aggrandising sense of who he was and what his status was, and also he lived his life amongst people of high status. William lived his life certainly amongst people of status when he was Dean of Wells, but also coming and going into exile and moving amongst scholars, and I think was much less concerned about what he looked like. What's interesting about William's monument is the density of the text, even though he wasn't represented in the way that his son ended up being.
Phil, I mean, we've got privileged access here, looking at this fantastic bust down in this vault. But when do you hope to see it back in the church?
By Christmas, we hope.
And is there going to be music and dancing
and
celebrations?
We're planning lots of celebrations. One of the things we've been looking at ever since we got particularly interested in William Turner is having maybe an annual lecture on aspects of science and faith. We're also planning modifications to our churchyard to honour William Turner's memory, where people can come and connect with William Turner and his work.
Well, that was a magnificent bust and an extraordinary story of the lost and the found. It's ironic, though, that Peter, the son, should have a memorial that's so much more important, so much more eye-catching than his father's. Peter did well enough. He studied medicine at Heidelberg and practiced very successfully as a doctor in London. He was a resident physician at St. Bartholomew's, and he treated some pretty prominent patients, including Sir Walter Raleigh. He also had some powerful patrons who secured him a seat in Parliament, where he sat on a committee for the better observing of the Sabbath day. He published a pamphlet on the efficacy of plague cakes, observing piously that it is neither herb nor salve nor anything like that healeth, but only the blessing of the head physician. I'm assuming he meant God rather than himself. But compared to the achievements of his father, all this is small beer. And Peter's working life was settled, easy. He studied abroad by choice, not from necessity. By escaping from England, William Turner at least avoided the fate of his Cambridge compatriots, Ridley and Latimer, both of them burned at the stake for their beliefs. But for most of his life, poor Turner was dogged by ill fortune. After that return in 1558 from the second exile, he pressed on with his great book, and within 4 years, he'd actually completed the second part. But unfortunately, Meardman, the London printer who'd brought out the first part of the herbal, had been forced to flee the country at the same time as Turner, but he hadn't returned. So the second part of the book was printed by Arnold Berkman in Cologne. It proved another stroke of bad luck. For reasons completely beyond his control, the printer of the first part of the herbal wasn't able to continue with the rest of it. But publishing in Germany, a book written in English, severely compromised its chances of success. Few on the continent could read it. Few in England could get hold of it. Not much is known about Turner's Northumbrian roots, but his life's work, that new herbal, is stitched through with references to the plants that grew there. The plane tree at Morpeth, the only one he knew of. The bluebell, the slimy juice of which his school friends used to glue their arrows and books. The herbal was actually a great landmark, providing in English, for the first time, recognisable descriptions of 238 British native plants and their natural habitats. The water lilies that favoured standing waters, the yellow-horned poppy most likely to be seen in places by the seaside. Like all who wrote about plants at that time, he also includes information about the ways they were used. Some women, he writes, sprinkle the flowers of cowslip with white wine and after still it and wash their faces to drive wrinkles away and to make them fair in the eyes of the world rather than in the eyes of God, whom they are not afraid to offend with the sluttishness, filthiness and foulness of the soul. Honeysuckle will cure hiccups, but had to be used sparingly, for it could induce impotence. Nutmeg was a very useful aphrodisiac for cold husbands that would fain have children. During Turner's periods of exile, an extraordinary web of contacts was being spun between scholars in Italy, France, Switzerland, Germany, and the Netherlands, all of whom shared that same passion for res herbaria, things to do with plants. Like the broadcasts beamed out from the first radio transmitters, the ideas that had first been debated in the Italian universities of the early 16th century spread out gradually over the rest of Europe. But this web
which so intricately connected like-minded people in mainland Europe, didn't, in William Turner's lifetime, include Britain. The universities at Oxford and Cambridge were slow to set up chairs or botanic gardens to facilitate the study of plants. The Oxford Botanic Garden, that was the first in Britain, was established 80 years after those at Pisa and Padua. And nobody in England had written a decent book on plants until Turner, the splenetic cleric, who chose to write in English. Perhaps Turner felt a kind of patriotic pride in abandoning Latin for his native tongue. Perhaps he had a vision of English as the language of scientific discourse. Perhaps he felt that if enough important books were published in English, scholars in other countries would have no option but to learn the language. It happened in the end, but Turner was ahead of his time. Produced in a foreign country in a foreign tongue, his books were never translated. He suffered the fate of many pioneers, to be forgotten. Unlucky Turner. Too soon, after he finally found himself in the right place at the right time, in England, in the 1560s, he died. And like so many pioneers, he died before the worth of what he was doing was recognised. His patient synthesising of plant names, names in Greek, Latin, English, French, German, Italian, banished much of the muddle that was bound to exist when common names were the only currency. With his wide range of contacts, Turner was responsible for stitching England into the plant map of Europe. The intellectual isolation that had marked the few English plantsmen of the first half of the 16th century had completely vanished by the second half. After Turner's death, England became a magnet for anyone interested in the study of plants. Back in 1540, Turner had fled to the continent to escape Catholic persecution. But 30 years later, and for the same reason, the great Flemish scholar Charles de Lobel, known as Lobelius, came in the opposite direction and, in terms of plantsmanship, found a country very different from the one Turner had had to leave. It was Turner who laid the foundation for the preeminence of this later generation of English plantsmen. John Goodyear, John Parkinson, John Ray. He was the vital link between the early scholar botanists and the later generation of more practical, experimental gardeners, many of whom were based here in London. But, as is the way with foundations, Turners were all too soon buried and forgotten. I do hope, though, that when Peter Turner's bust comes back here to St. Olave's with all the pomp and circumstance that it deserves, someone will remember his rather more important father. This board by the church porch that lists the names of the worthies of St. Olave's ought surely to include the father of English botany, the great William Turner.
And that was Anna Papert celebrating her great gardening hero, William Turner. The producer was B.T. Rubens. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall with me, Katie Derham, and welcoming back to this all-English prom here on Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms. And if you would like to know more about this evening's programme, don't forget the notes are available on the Radio 3 website right now, and they are free. They're very, very detailed and very good, I should add. Well, in true Olympic spirit, we have the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and the BBC National Chorus of Wales, plus the BBC Symphony Chorus, all conducted by the Japanese conductor Tadaaki Otaka. With me here in the box is Adrian Partington, who's the chorus master of the National Chorus of Wales. And Adrian, you've got a very busy season because this is just the first of four concerts, isn't it?
Yes, we have. We've got two more within 2 weeks. Next Monday, we're taking part in this Bernstein extravaganza.
The Mass, the premiere of that.
The Mass, yes. Very exciting. It's an all Welsh cast and it's an all Welsh young cast. It's very exciting. So we've got school children, we've got university students. And then shortly after that, we have our chief conductor's final concert. Thierry Fisher is sadly leaving us, and that is Berlioz's Grande Messe des Morts, which will involve 450 singers. And then finally, the Martyrdom of St. Sebastian by Debussy later in the month.
Very busy, but extremely worthwhile projects, all of them. And as I said earlier, in fine voice, if I may say.
Thank you.
Well, they are on stage now, but they're going to be quiet for the next 10 minutes or so, as we're going to be starting the second half of this prom with Delius and his wonderfully blissful pastoral, The Walk to Paradise Garden, an orchestral intermezzo from his opera, A Village Romeo and Juliet. It was Delius' fourth opera and tells the familiar tragic story, but in a rural mountain setting. And the walk to the Paradise Garden comes between the last two scenes. The two lovers leave rather unfriendly types at a local fair and walk to the Paradise Garden Inn, where they fall in with a group of gypsies. Midway through the interlude in the opera, the curtains part to share the lovers pausing to kiss. Well, coming to the stage now is conductor Tadaaki Otaka to conduct the BBC National Orchestra of Wales in Delius's Walk to the Paradise Garden. Delia says the walk to the Paradise Garden, performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. And Adrian Partington, conductor Tadaki Ataka, has really been tugging on our heartstrings with the programme so far this evening, hasn't he? They've all these sweet lyrical pieces, marvellously performed.
They have indeed. That Delius is a truly beautiful piece. But the mood, I'm afraid, is about to change somewhat.
The volume is about to be turned up. You're absolutely right.
It certainly is. So we've all been lulled into a false sense of peace.
So loins should be girded as we're about to be, immersed?
Yes, probably.
Drenched in the work of William Walton, because we have a work now that was once described as the best choral work written for 50 years. It's William Walton's oratorio, Belshazzar's Feast. He wrote it in 1930 and 1931 and set text arranged by Osbert Sitwell from biblical sources, primarily the Book of Daniel and Psalm 137, by the waters of Babylon. It is, as we've been suggesting, a huge piece. It has two full choruses, plus an extra brass band, in this case, London Brass. Famously, Thomas Beecham, directing the Leeds Festival where the work had its premiere, rather scathingly said, "As you'll never hear the thing again, my boy, why not throw in a couple of brass bands?" So Walton did, which makes it very, very loud indeed. Now, tonight, the brass band has been split into two, and they're actually in two boxes right up at the top of the hall, facing each other across the stage, far left and far right. The soloist tonight is baritone Jonathan Lamalu, ex-Radio 3 New Generation artist, and I asked him earlier what he felt about his role in this work.
I love the fact that it's declamatory, it's very narrative. I love the fact that not many composers will trust a singer to sing a cappella, and Walton kind of does, which is kind of cool, to his detriment. And those are the two things that I really enjoy. I love the fact that even though you have these orchestral, monumental moments, you can also have the narrator commenting, and some moments being declamatory. It seems like his personal view on the story that's going about. So that's what I enjoy about the Walton.
Talking of personal views, standing on the stage of the Proms and looking out at the Royal Albert Hall whilst having nobody supporting you, that must be quite something.
It's cool. I mean, the Albert Hall and the Proms, it's such a fixture in the world music scene. I've been lucky enough to do a few of them, and it doesn't get old. I just love the adrenaline. I love everything about Promming. It's just a great thing in London.
Jonathan Lamalu talking to me earlier about how cool it is to be singing here. Well, Adrian Partington, chorus master of the National Chorus. It isn't just about bass baritones like Jonathan, is it? It's very much a choral work.
It is
a
choral
work.
And it's
tough, isn't it?
It's very hard indeed. There's two issues, really. There's a stamina issue, particularly for the tenors and the sopranos. They have to sing lots of high, loud notes for a very long time. But worse than that is the tuning of the unaccompanied quiet bits. Walton's harmony is very sophisticated, and it's very hard to do. So my fingers are crossed.
No need to worry, I'm sure. Here comes our bass baritone, our soloist tonight, Jonathan Lamalu, and with him, the conductor, Tadaki Ataka, to conduct William Walton's Belshazzar's Feast.
Thank you. Babylon was a great merchandise was of gold and silver, of precious stones, of pearls, of fine linen, of purple, silk, and scarlet, all manner vessels of ivory, all manner vessels of most precious wood, of brass, iron, and marble, cinnamon, odors, and ointments, of frankincense, wine, and oil, fine flour, wheat, and beasts, sheep, horses, chariots, slaves. And the souls of
crazy. Of the hand that wrote. And this was the writing that was written.
Thank you.
What a work, what a performance. Belshazzar's Feast by William Walton, performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, the BBC National Chorus of Wales, the BBC Symphony Chorus, London Brass, soloist the bass baritone Jonathan Lamalu, and conductor Tadaki Otsaka. Fabulous response here in the hall, crowd on their feet. Such a brilliant work. Those snappy jazzy rhythms next to traditional choral writing. You've got massive walls of sound and then a solo voice. Wonderful, wonderful, effective writing. Well, Tadaki Otsaka and Jonathan Lamalu coming back onto the stage now to take another bow. The applause doesn't really sound like it's abating in any way, does it? Jonathan Lamalu, ex-BBC New Generation artist, joining the audience and congratulating the two choruses. So ably trained by their chorus masters, Stephen Jackson for the BBC Symphony Chorus, and my guest tonight, Adrian Partington, chorus master of the National Chorus of Wales. Well, if you've enjoyed it, you've got a chance to listen again via the website. You can also see it on BBC 4 on Thursday, the 9th of August, week on Thursday, 7:30. Don't miss that. The cameras have been in tonight, so a chance to see, as well as hear, that beautiful music again. I'm going to love you and leave you as the crowd here continue to cheer and stamp for the orchestras and musicians on the stage. It is time for me now, though, to hand you back to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Katie, thank you very much indeed. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall tonight with the first of our two proms this evening. And as Katie mentioned, you can hear the prom and see it on the BBC website. You can also hear the whole prom again when we rebroadcast it a week today here on Radio 3 on Afternoon on 3, Tuesday the 7th of August. That's from 2 o'clock. Well, tomorrow night, another BBC orchestra takes to the stage at the Albert Hall, this time the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and their American principal guest conductor David Robertson will be in charge. And after that evening of English music, they're going to raise the stars and stripes tomorrow evening. Charles Ives will dominate the first half of the concert. His famous cosmic landscape, as he called it, The Unanswered Question, begins the concert. You can also hear Samuel Barber's hauntingly beautiful Adagio for Strings. And then Hawken Hardenberger will be joining the orchestra as the soloist in a spiritual-inspired trumpet concerto by Bernd Zimmermann. And to end the evening, Tippett's A Child of Our Time, the orchestra joined by the BBC Proms Youth Choir for that performance. You can hear the entire concert live here on BBC Radio 3 beginning at 7:30 tomorrow evening. Well, as I say, that was the first visit of the night to the BBC Proms. We're going to be there later this evening at 10:15 for a late-night prom, an evening of accordion music from Colombia. Radio 3's World Roots Academy apprentice, José Hernando Aria Noguera. You may have heard him on In Tune earlier this evening playing live. He'll be taking centre stage and playing very much live, together with a formidable lineup of Colombian musicians playing songs old and new from his homeland. That's at 10:15 tonight. Before then, Richard Coles will be here to embark on a global gay history, a second chance to hear his four-part series for Radio 3 on the history of same-sex desire. And in part one tonight, Richard visits Egypt, amongst other places, and a contested tomb containing two ancient Egyptian men who are thought to be either lovers or brothers. And he also comes a little closer to our own day to tell the story of a woman from the early 19th century who had same-sex relationships. But the question is, should we label her as a lesbian? The difficulties of excavating the history of homosexuality are brought out in Out in the World, a global gay history, tonight at 9:30 here on BBC Radio 3. Well, to take us to that point, music from another special festival that takes place each summer in Europe. You may have heard our live relay from Lugano in Switzerland a few weeks ago, a special festival which takes place there each and every year. It's the work of the pianist Marta Argerich, and she invites some tip-top brilliant musicians to join her on stage. And during a month-long celebration of music, she establishes all sorts of new relationships between those well-known names and up-and-coming musicians. They all come together to work together in performance. Thankfully, they also record the concerts, and the recordings are always worth revisiting. This is a recording made during their get-together in 2009. And on this occasion, Marta Argerich was joined by fellow pianist Christina Martin to play a two-piano version of Mendelssohn's incidental music to A Midsummer Night's Dream. Here's the overture, followed by the scherzo.
Thank you.
The Overture and Scherzo from Mendelssohn's A Midsummer Night's Dream in a live performance given at Marta Argerich's Lugano Festival in 2009. Argerich playing one of the pianos there, the other was played by Christina Martin. This is BBC Radio 3. I'm Ian Skelly here with the music at the moment as we head to the first of our four-part series, A Global Gay History, presented by Richard Coles. And that music is by Vivaldi next, a concerto for cello, a bright and sunny piece, this one. The cellist Christophe Coin is joined by Il Giordano Armonico, directed by Giovanni Antonini.
Thank you.
Cellist Christoph Kwan playing the cello concerto by Vivaldi, RV411 from the 1720s, with Il Giordano Armonico, directed by Giovanni Antonini. And that brings the time to 9:30 rather. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. Next tonight, a chance to hear our series Out in the World, a global gay history, presented by Richard Coles, which was first broadcast last year. In his first programme tonight, which does contain some explicit historical examples, Richard explores the very real challenges of excavating homosexuality in the distant and not so distant past.
Morning rush hour, Cairo. I'm in the back of a cab and we're heading out of the centre of the contemporary city where there's been much turmoil in the past few days with the trial of former President Hosni Mubarak happening at the police academy. It's early in the morning but the sun is already smiting us. Smog is already hanging grey, turning brown in the sky. We're heading out towards Saqqara, which is a funeral complex that served Memphis, the capital of the Old Kingdom, 4,500 years ago. I'm in Egypt and courting controversy to look at what some say is perhaps the earliest evidence for homosexuality that exists. It's where this series begins, and it's also where it ends, for not far from the site of ancient tombs in the desert is Tahrir Square, rallying point for the Egyptian revolution. It's too early to say what will emerge from it. A democratic pluralist state on the Western model, or an Islamic Republic offering a very different version of modernity. It's a critical moment for the entire nation, not least for the country's gays and lesbians, as Mustafa Fati knows well. He's the author of Egypt's first gay novel, and I thought we were courting controversy.
When I wrote my book, a lot of media talk, I have an agenda from America. We have to kill this writer. There is no homosexuality in our society. It's not true. In the revolution, the Egyptian revolution, there is a lot of gays in El Tahrir Square. You know, I know them, and I saw a lot of gays in El Tahrir Square. And that means something very important. They are Egyptian.
Interesting that for Mustafa, the presence of gay men and women in Tahrir Square during those crucial days writes them into history. But then gay activists and fellow travellers tend to have a feeling for history. Evidence for the existence of gay people at all times and in all places helps the effort to achieve equal rights. But defining, let alone uncovering gay history, if I can put it like that, is highly problematic. Theme of our first programme and my visit to the historic site of Saqqara. We've driven about an hour out of Cairo. To my right, there's palm trees and green.
then to my left, on the other side of the road, there's just a rising slope of rock and sand. So then all of a sudden these huge structures, there's a stepped pyramid that has just risen up in front of us, and then tomb openings which are cut into the light sandy coloured rock. Here we go to pull it and park.
The step pyramid of King Unas, the last king of the 5th dynasty, is surrounded by the tombs of high-ranking officials of the royal court, and I'm here to visit one in particular. We're well off the tourist beat. No one's asked me to ride their camel for at least an hour. It seems that even the Egyptians know little of this place. My guide is Dr. Ramadan Hussein, head of documentation in Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities.
Well, we're standing in a sort of depression, you know, and there's a cut through the landscape here in Saqqara. It's like a kind of grand causeway, would you call it that?
It's a causeway, yeah.
It's a causeway, and that's cut off, and it would have passed over. I mean, it's broken now, but right in the middle of that break, there's a massive structure, almost a kind of military bunker made of massive stone. And this, Ramadan, is the tomb that we've come to see.
Yep. It's the tomb of Nianknum and Khnumhotep.
So we go down some steps now. Impossible not to feel like Lord Carnarvon on such occasions, you know? Mm. And when was the tomb excavated, Ramadan?
It was excavated in 1964, and it was actually found in a very ruined state, and some of the blocks were found away from the tomb, reused in the causeway of King Unas. So clearly the tomb in antiquity has been demolished completely.
I'm about to enter a very unusual mastaba. Unusual because it was built for two men. Some say it's a monument to a gay relationship.
Oh, look at this. Wonderful. There's this narrow entrance, and there's a sort of vestibule here. And it's faced with stone, which is covered with relief carving. It's fantastic. Beautiful stuff. The quality is wonderful. We have a fisherman here who speared some fish.
And the fisherman here is actually one of the tomb owners, Nianknum and Khnumhotep. The most important of all the themes is what we're looking at right this minute, which is the tomb owner is spearing two tilapia fishes, killing evil that is embodied into these tilapia fishes. Because in Egyptian theology, the tilapia fish is a representation of evil. And one of these important things that every tomb owner had to perform in the afterlife is maintaining cosmic order.
Carvings on either side, a heavy lintel. Let me move through that to... It's actually a complex of rooms.
It's a multi-chamber tomb that we usually call it in Egyptological literature, mastaba, which is composed of two structures, the superstructure where you have all these multiple chambers with the reliefs on the walls, and then a substructure where you have a huge shaft that leads into the burial chamber.
About 12 feet high, all the walls covered with bands of extraordinary vivid decoration. Beautiful carved reliefs, and also quite a lot of the colour has survived quite well.
Everything in the tomb is really fitting very well with the decorum that has been set for the decorative program of the Old Kingdom tombs. Nothing is unusual in the tomb, except that we're dealing with two men here.
They're holding hands, two male figures holding hands.
Right.
Would that be very unusual?
It's very unusual, because this particular pose is reserved to the wife of the deceased. The deceased and his wife. We don't have any other tomb than actually we have two men sharing the same tomb and also allowing themselves to be represented in this very close physical context. So we're actually facing some intriguing scenes that we have to think about them. It's very open for several interpretation.
What do the hieroglyphics tell us?
Well, the hieroglyphics, one of the things that is also important with this scene that you see the deceased with his wife, his family members, either the daughters or the sons.
So let's be clear about this. This is someone who is married.
Who is married.
And a father.
And a father. The very fact that we have two people, two male, buried in this tomb, has his own wife and children, it makes it also problematic to think about the relation between these two.
And then we go through here from the right, and then into a sort of open courtyard. And then to the left of it, there's another kind of massive doorway, steps up. Then we move into a dramatically darker space. It's lit now with fluorescent tubes, which could enable you to see the reliefs more clearly. And in the centre of it, on the pillar, between the two doors that lead in, we have perhaps the most striking relief in the whole complex. We've got the two figures here, and they're actually touching nose to nose.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as near to a kiss as you can get.
This is actually how kiss is being represented in Egyptian art.
And so the figure on the right has his arm around the shoulder of the figure. I mean, they're actually kind of drawn together, drawing each other together.
Yeah.
And it's just this tiny distance separating one nose from the other.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very delicate relief.
Would it be too much to construe from that that there is a particular character of intimacy, unusually for a male pair being shown here? Or would that be just to kind of go too far?
Well, I wouldn't say we go too far. It's very intriguing to see something like that. We haven't seen it before Nyankhonom and Khnumhotep. This physical intimacy is very reserved for the man and wife in a representation. But we're seeing here now between two men. Are we dealing with two gay lovers? We might be. Are we not? That is a possibility as well.
Yeah. Stunning.
It's beautiful.
I've never been in Egyptian zoo before.
It is amazing. I mean,
very tempting to think that I'm looking at an image of two lovers, but many Egyptologists look at it quite differently.
I don't think it's completely out of the question, but it does seem to me to be the least likely way to understand it.
Professor John Baines of Oxford University has written about the tomb.
I suggested that this was an elaborate presentation of two men who were twins, and because they are twin brothers, and the category of being a twin was suppressed, as it were, socially, they had to have an altogether exceptional treatment in order to be viable for owning a monument, and probably for their roles in life. And so I think they are essentially shown as if they were a single person, because there is some sort of taboo surrounding twin status, and it has to be addressed in some way.
A good lesson in the historiography of homosexuality. Two men depicted holding hands and kissing, however intimate it might appear, is not necessarily a depiction of homosexuality. We see what we want to see? Maybe. But isn't that true of all interpreters?
The whole process of recovering ancient societies is one of interpretation. And the number of facts that we have is very limited. So if we are going to look at a tomb like this one, then we need to immerse ourselves in the material of the period, and that tells you about a world of discourse and presentation, and it doesn't tell you directly about how people led their lives. So if either of these men had boyfriends, this is something that is conceivable, but I have no evidence either way. We simply can't get at all easily beyond the monument to the lives that people led.
You only have to look back to painting in the 19th century to be surprised by what our ancestors found erotic. Dr. Richard Parkinson looks back much further than that. His assistant keeper of ancient Egyptian pharaonic culture at the British Museum.
We have a papyrus which shows the naked god of the earth, Geb, curling over and sucking himself off. And to us, this looks like a piece of pornography. It's in a religious papyrus, buried with a priestess. It's extremely formal religious art. And clearly, the scene is meant to show that the earth is marvelous in its self-sustaining fecundity. But to us, it looks very much like a bit of pornography. But then you wonder whether people could possibly look at such symbolism without seeing it as something sexual. It's very, very hard to get that balance right between how it was meant to be seen, how the ancients saw it, and how we see it.
The key problem here is that the word homosexuality and the concept that goes with it goes back only 100 years or so, as we will discover. And it's very much a Western idea. Trying to apply it to the ancients or to cultures contemporary with but different from our own is tricky.
I think the main difficulty in constructing a history of homosexuality is ourselves and our preconceptions and our assumptions.
Dr. Matt Holbrook of Oxford University.
We inhabit this contemporary world where there's a pervasive and powerful assumption that we have a sexuality. We have a sexuality that's often the core of our personal being and forms the core of our personal identity. And in attempting to write the history of sexuality, in effect, we're projecting that assumption, that understanding back onto the past.
What's difficult about doing the history of sexuality is that we are operating with a framework of knowing the sexual that we inherited from the late 19th century and early 20th centuries. That's our frame.
Professor Laura Dode of Manchester University.
That frame determines the way that we can think about the sexual past, but it also constrains how we're able to historicize. So the challenge for the historian of sexuality is to be able to stand back and actually see that frame, try to work with it, but also try to break it apart and work outside of it.
We encounter this idea in the work of the French philosopher and critic Michel Foucault, Professor Chris Waters of Williams College in Massachusetts.
Foucault argued in many ways that we have to look at the difference between sexual behavior and sexual identity. Sexual identity, homosexual identity in particular, is a very recent phenomenon. While we have homosexual behavior before the 1880s, 1890s, we don't have sexual identities. We don't have individuals who conceive of themselves as a unique type of being, a species of being. And therefore, we have to study how that transformation comes about. And it's a story that a lot of people have challenged. A lot of people argue that there's no watertight division between the pre-late 19th century and the post-late 19th century, that to speak in terms of practices here and identities there creates an arbitrary divide that just can't exist. And while there's a lot of questioning of the model, it's in many ways informed not only debates amongst historians, but the kind of work that historians do.
Doors open. Third floor.
We're being buzzed through the security doors at the Wellcome Institute that lead to the Wellcome Library, which is one of the biggest collections of this kind of material anywhere. Is this where
this
we need
is
to
the
be?
Viewing rooms.
Oh, excellent.
Okay. Medical historians from all over the world beat a path to its door. And in its archive, many of the pioneering works of the 19th century sexologists may be found, some of them crucial to the evolution in our time of the understanding of homosexuality.
Morning.
Morning.
Hello, Leslie. Richard Coles.
I'm here to meet senior archivist Leslie Hall.
Mrs. Craft Ebbing in here.
Mrs. Craft Ebbing here. I got out a small selection from the collection, which
among the Wellcome Library's treasures are the complete papers of Richard von Craft Ebbing.
We've got his case notes.
Oh, look at this.
Mostly in German and in this really rather impenetrable late 19th century Germanic handwriting.
Craft Ebbing was one of the earliest and most important sexologists.
Possibly the first medical man who ventilated the subject outside medical societies discussing odd cases they'd come across, because earlier in the century, and indeed well into the 20th, if you look in medical manuals, the only discussion of sex between men is how you discover the evidence for sodomitic practices.
So that would be leading to a sort of forensic purpose?
Yes, it's because obviously in most European countries, sex between men, quote-unquote sodomy, was criminalised. It wasn't in France, but in Germany, in the Netherlands, in the UK.
But Craft Ebbing was doing something different. He was trying to capture information or look at the phenomenon from a different point of view.
He was trying to understand it. He wasn't just trying to say, oh my God, this is like weird, or, you know, this is like, let's condemn these people, let's bang them up in madhouses.
In 1886, he published Psychopathia Sexualis, an attempt to list the range of sexualities he'd come across in his case studies, many of which were sent in by homosexual people themselves.
You see the note he's put on there, psychically hermaphroditic, and one of the ways he was trying to understand, or people were trying to understand homosexuality, was through the idea of a kind of internal hermaphroditism, that, you know, it was like the soul of a woman in the body of a man, and vice versa, of course, in the case of lesbians.
Trying to understand the nature of same-sex desire by
saying, you know, they're actually a blend of the two sexes in some way. I must just show you this because it's in terms of, you know, people sending things to Craft Ebbing.
Oh, look at this.
Look at that. It's a chap in a corset.
It's a photograph, presumably from 1890s, around that
Yeah,
period.
Around about 1890s. I'm not sure we have an exact date.
And it's very obviously a man, but a man dressed in a corset. He's got stockings, high-heeled shoes. He's showing a lot of bum and a lot of thigh. And his
I think it's either a wig or it's a very kind of boofy hairdo.
Yeah.
And he's standing there holding a fan with elbow-length gloves and looking at the camera in a slightly imploring way. Understand me.
Yes.
Oh, look here.
Yes, we've got a set. We've also got the one in sort of as a female Greek dancer type person.
They look slightly made complex by him wearing a moustache.
Yes. Yeah. It's. I mean, at this point, I don't think the people who are thinking about the subject have kind of teased out the differences between homosexuality, transvestism, and what we might now think of as an actual trans identity.
So that's happening in Germany. At what point does this kind of research begin to make an impact in Britain?
Well, there is already interest happening in the UK. For example, John Addington Symonds, who is kind of an early, as it were, homophile campaigner in the UK, he published a book called A Problem in Greek Ethics in the 1880s.
So what is the problem in Greek
ethics? The problem in Greek ethics is the fact that you know, they are regarded as, you know, the founding fathers of modern civilization, and all they had the virtue, civics, you know, philosophy, foundations of modern science, etc., etc. And yet, you know, they saw nothing wrong with this practice that is regarded as criminal, degraded, sinful, and bestial in Victorian England.
Symonds collaborated with the physician and psychologist Henry Havelock Ellis to write Sexual Inversion, the first English medical textbook on homosexuality.
This is the actual original version, and he says, and I think this is very nice, "I found in time that several persons for whom I felt respect and admiration were the congenital subjects of this abnormality. And at the same time, I realised that in England, more than in any other country, the law and public opinion combined to place a heavy penal burden and a severe social stigma on the manifestation of an instinct which, to those persons who possess it, frequently appears natural and normal. It was clear that the matter was in special need of elucidation and discussion." And they've just completed it, and Symonds dies. Symonds had TB. He was living in Switzerland for his TB, and he dies at a relatively young age. And his executors go, "Mr. Ellis, we feel that the family would not be happy with having Mr. Symonds' name associated with this book. Could you take his name off? And by the way, could you rewrite it entirely to make sure there is nothing that anybody could pick up that he had anything to do with it whatsoever?" So it's very rare to have this edition which actually has Ellis's and Symonds' name, because the executors really went round buying it up and destroying it.
Would it be fair to say that we're seeing something coming into focus?
Yes, I think it's absolutely true that there is this sense that certain things have been kind of swirling around in a somewhat inchoate way, trying to find ways of understanding it that aren't just about saying these people are degraded criminals, or these are evil sinners who need to repent and reform. Why do people do this?
In a sense, Leslie, we could call these foundational documents in terms of a kind of scientific attempt to understand.
Oh, yes, in terms of understanding, these are, I think, foundational documents. Yeah.
In Havelock Ellis's view, sexual inversion is an innate condition, the view of many today in one form or another, and an important argument in the battle for legal reform. But it was challenged by Freud and some of his followers, who gave a contrasting account. Professor Chris Waters of Williams College in Massachusetts.
A very different kind of story, a developmental story, a story of the development of forms of behaviour, a deviation from the norm due to family circumstances and upbringing, which is very much in conflict with the notions of innate inversion that Havelock Ellis puts forward. And in the 1920s and the 1930s, particularly the latter decade, there's a lot of sort of battles between people in one camp or in the other.
The sexologists were influential primarily in Europe, but across the Atlantic, Freud's ideas gained ground.
In the United States, there is a lot more money put into treatment of homosexuality, and the notion that if this is a psychosexual aberration, mapped in Freudian terms, then we can correct the anomaly. And therefore, treatment centres, psychiatrists who are willing to treat homosexuals and prefer cures for homosexuality, that practice is much more widespread in the United States.
And then two large volumes here, Leslie, with Hirschfeld.
Yes, these are Magnus Hirschfeld, published 1920. This is the period when he's setting up his Institute for Sexueller Wissenschaft in Berlin.
Sexual wisdom.
Yeah, sexual knowledge, wisdom, learning. And he's very dedicated, both investigator of homosexuality, and he's very active in the campaign to reform the German penal code.
This is
his huge, thick volume.
It's interesting that the law at this time was exclusively interested in male homosexuality.
Oh, yes, it wasn't.
And is that reflected, too, in the work of people like Simmons and Krafft-Ebing? Are they interested in female homosexuality?
They do mention female homosexuality, but there are far fewer cases. This is partly because, in the case of Krafft-Ebing, he's seeing people who can afford to consult him. So, therefore, you know, you have probably got far more men who are able to consult an elite psychiatrist than women. And as it wasn't illegal for women, it is not quite such a critical thing anyway. Women are often, there tends to be a perception that women can have beautiful and devoted friendships, particularly if they're not going to marry anyway. You often get women setting up households together. But it can't possibly be about sex because, you know, women don't have desire, or at least they only have desire if they have a husband and their husband, as it were, awakens it.
So the sexologists really framed our modern understanding of homosexuality by giving us the language. There are, however, compelling examples which predate the language. I'm on the train to Halifax, not perhaps up there with Fire Island and Mykonos as a locus of same-sex fun, but a woman near there in the early 19th century sounds very much like a modern lesbian. Indeed, her diaries have been called the Rosetta Stone of lesbianism, and this year were included in UNESCO's Memory of the World Register. But can we actually call her a lesbian? In 1826, Anne Lister inherited Shibden Hall, a solid stone house with touches of a rather un-Yorkshire flamboyance.
Richard.
Hello. Hi. Nice to meet you.
My guide is curator Claire Selby.
Central part of the hall is medieval, but the extensions were actually done by Anne Lister.
She's a very interesting character, isn't she? Born in, I think, in the 1790s.
Yes, 1791.
And died, I think, at the age of 49.
Yes. She wasn't actually the daughter of the house. She actually, her unmarried aunt and uncle lived here. So they were brother and sister, obviously had no children themselves, so they had to pass it on to another member of the family.
So heading up the stairs, there's a sort of balustraded landing. Again, it's sort of half-timbered and heavy. Some of it medieval, some of it, I think, kind of retro. And then we come into a sort of landing. Again, it's very ancient. You can tell from the huge wooden floorboards. There's a hatchment on our left. And then in front of us, a room right above the porch. Claire, this room is particularly significant when we talk about Anne Lister's journals, the very nearly lost journals.
Yes, I mean, this is where we think Anne Lister's journals were walled up behind the wooden panels that you can see by her descendant, John Lister. The diaries and a lot of her papers were brought back from Russia, where she actually died in 1840, by her wife, Anne Walker. You know, the papers were all in the house. And it was her descendant, John Lister, who was the person who actually cracked the code of the diaries.
Because the diaries weren't written in straightforward script, they were, parts of them were coded.
That's absolutely right. The diaries, they're very extensive, over 4 million words, and about a sixth of them are written in a code of Anne Lister's own devising.
It must be the inflammatory stuff, if she felt it necessary to write them in code and if her descendant thought it necessary to hide them.
Well, yes. I mean, they refer to certain things like financial matters, which she obviously didn't want people to know about, but the main body of them does refer in quite explicit detail to her relationships with women.
There's a very small portrait next to her hatchment here. It's beautiful, but again, very striking. There she is, dressed in black, what looks like a frock coat. She's sitting, and in her hand she has a letter or a document of some kind. And then her head, done in ringlets, typical of the period, but there's something very strikingly masculine about her.
It shows what she thinks is important. The letter, the document in her hand, shows that is clearly what is a huge part of her life, her writing, her academia, her study. But as you say, the picture isn't merely a flattering portrait. It's a very striking and a very handsome picture. nature, but you certainly wouldn't refer to her as a beautiful woman. It's quite a masculine portrait.
The diaries are now kept by the West Yorkshire Archive Service in Halifax.
What we're looking for is G5, because at G5, here I've piles of boxes here, records of Shibden and ML, that's Miss Lister.
Much of which were written in what Anne Lister called cryptand, a sort of jumble of Greek and algebraic characters.
Oh, there's the very, very first page. Is that right, Helena, written by Anne Lister, the first page from the first channel? Is it
1806.
Helena Whitbread, leading authority on Anne Lister, happened upon the diaries in the archive when, as a mature student, she was looking for a research topic.
And the poignant note is Eliza Lefters, and that is the absolute seed of the voluminous journals of 6,600 pages that took Anne through the rest of her life.
I feel almost like I'm handling a sort of New Testament papyrus, because there's a tiny scrap and then this tiny hand. But this is more than... We're not talking about girlish crushes here. We're talking about something much more significant.
Absolutely. The purpose of the journals, first of all, was to record her love affair with Eliza Raine, and they had quite a red-hot affair. They called each other husband and wife. And Eliza came to Halifax when Anne could no longer stay at school. And that's how the journal started, with that first phrase, Eliza left us. Then, as time went on, obviously other lovers took the place of Eliza. And again, it was necessary for her to disguise those affairs. But also, the journal is a significant tool for Anne, in which she could develop and construct her own sexual persona as a lesbian in an era when the word wasn't used, and she had no supportive structure. She didn't know any other lesbians to speak of, although one or two of her lovers were lesbians, but they never used that term. So within the pages of the journal, her attempt to find a place for herself in society, to construct her own sexuality and to brave the world is depicted in the code.
Do we have a sense of where the origins of her own lesbianism lie?
What she tells us is told in retrospect, when she's confiding to her women lovers. And she will say, she said, "I had images of perfection in my mind, but they were never men. It was always a woman." And that was when she was quite young, 10 or 11. She knew that she had very, very masculine traits. She wore stout black walking boots. She had a stride like a man. She decided to dress entirely in black in 1817.
Which would have been... high-status males would normally only be so attired at that time.
Yes, it was very masculine for a woman to dress in black. So from then on, she was a very, very striking figure in the town. And every time she went into the town, she sort of ran the gamut of ribald remarks.
So even with all her social prestige, that didn't protect her from the vivid commentary of passers-by?
We're looking at Sunday, the 28th of June, in 1818. And she says, "The people generally remark as I pass along how much I am like a man. I think they did it more than usual this morning. At the top of Cunnery Lane, as I went, three men said, as usual, 'That's a man.' And one axed," as she put it, A-X-E-D, "'Does your cock stand? I know not how it is, but I feel low this evening.'" But I have to say that she never deviated from her desire to live her life as a man would. And she was determined not to get married. It didn't matter, you know, what scandal there was in the town, she rode it.
And were her partners, her romantic, erotic partners, did they tend to a more sort of feminine model?
She liked her women to be ultra-feminine. I think the person that was a lesbian was Isabella Norcliffe. And Isabella was too rough and tough for Anne. She wanted to do all the masculine things, did Isabella. She drank heavily, she took snuff, and Anne said, "She will not do for me." Mariana was delicate, feminine, gentle, as was Eliza Raine, and she liked her women to be very soft and very feminine, ultra-feminine.
Did she experience any anxiety herself about who she was, about her identity, about her sexuality? Was it something that troubled her?
Absolutely not. She said, "This is my nature. God created me, and I must act according to the nature which God gave me." It would be more wrong in me to marry than indulging in all this foolishness, which she meant by that flirting with women. She thought she was entitled to a full sexual life.
As Anne accepted her desires, she sought also to understand them.
So her mission was to comb the classics. She reverted to classical literature to find instances of homosexuality, female homosexuality. She could depict, she would use such as the poetry of Byron, who, as we know, was bisexual. She had many devious tactics by which she was able to search for any evidence of her own sexuality way back in the past.
But even if Anne Lister's lesbian life and sensibility predates the publication of the sexologists' theories by some decades, it wasn't until the 20th century that their ideas were taken up more widely. Professor Laura Doane.
Sexuality was incoherent. It was messy. They invented a language to think about human beings as sexual. This language they developed is recorded in these very esoteric volumes, which are not available to the general public. These materials begin to increase gradually through the early part of the 20th century. Then we get to the midpoint of the last century, and these words begin to become available across the wider public.
The term homosexual is a product of the mid-19th century, and it's a product of the kind of sexological project that was emerging at that time.
Dr. Matt Holbrook.
But if we want to look for the origins of these binary oppositions between homosexual and heterosexual, or gay or straight, if we want to look for a moment at which lives were organised around those boundaries, around exclusive desires for men or exclusive desires for women, then actually its origins are startlingly recent. In Britain, for example, it's probably only as late as the 1950s or the 1960s that this sort of this way of organising desire or identity becomes hegemonic, becomes dominant.
So, is Anne Lister a lesbian or not?
When we claim Anne Lister to be a lesbian, we are using her to help us maybe understand something about ourselves now, or to make us feel that there is a continuity between lesbians of the past and lesbians of the present. Anne Lister means something to us now. She's part of a lesbian heritage. But what that doesn't achieve is it obscures knowing how Anne was able to know herself at the time she was sleeping with women. She would not have thought of herself as a lesbian. She might have thought of herself as a man who desired women, so that the story of Anne Lister could be a story about gender variance, not about sexuality.
One phrase in the journal says, "I am neither man nor woman in society. How shall I manage?" And in another, she discusses her sexuality with Maria Barlow in Paris. "I said I had thought much, studied anatomy, etc., could not find it out. Could not understand myself. It was all the effect of the mind. No exterior formation accounted for it. Alluded to there being an internal correspondence or likeness of some of the male or female organs of generation. Alluded to the stones not slipping through the ring till after birth." She didn't want to be a man, but as she said, "I would never have had access to women's boudoirs had I been a man." So she was happy to be a woman with a man's inclinations towards women. And that was the way she could inveigle them into bed with her. To a man, the boudoir doors would have been closed for these young single women, but not for Anne Lister.
I've sometimes characterised especially the history of lesbianism as something of a hunting expedition. The historian of lesbianism turns to the past and finds a group of women. We pluck them out of history, whether it's Anne Lister or maybe it's Radcliffe Hall. And there are some scholars who have described these women as sort of shimmering resemblances. Oh, that woman seems like me, or this other woman seems like us. I would not want to take away those shimmering resemblances. You can have those. But to historians, I would say that shimmering is a mirage. It's a mirage on the desert landscape of the sexual past.
Just coming down a slope, still on the sacred site of Saqqara. Ahead of us, over a couple of mounds of sand and stone, you can see Cairo in the distance, kind of wreathed in smog. Two more pyramids on the horizon. Again, not the sort of great pyramids of Cheops, that kind of thing, but sort of stepped pyramids like ziggurats. You can look into the landscape and see a guy in robes and a headdress sitting on a donkey taking off across what a landscape which won't have changed in thousands of years.
Sun is, ungodly strong.
It is unbelievable. Isn't it? From the Rosetta Stone of Halifax to the Rosetta Stone of ancient Egypt, or at least to its locale at ancient Memphis, Dr. Ramadan Hussein is helping me search there for further evidence of same-sex relations in the time of the pharaohs.
The landscape is so amazing and captivating. You see all this massive desert, and in the far distance, you see the palm trees just rising. So captivating for us, and for the ancient Egyptian, was the same. Desert is always connected with death, but the valley where the vegetation is always connected with life.
And trekking across the desert to another tomb, or mastaba. In here, I'm told, there's clearer evidence of homosexual activity in ancient Egypt. At the foot of the steps, you come to the front of the tomb, which is massive, 20 feet high, two great pillars on either side, and a sort of colonnade. Limestone covered with carvings, hieroglyphics, also scenes from everyday life, as a sign above us tells us in Arabic script, and also in English. It's the tomb of Ti from the 5th dynasty, around 2400 BC, or before Common Era. At the corner of the courtyard, there's an entry through a wall. Again, it's all carved. That leads to a corridor, a long corridor. We move through that. It's very narrow, quite claustrophobic and dark. And then we come through into a much bigger room. It's a big chamber, actually, I think 20 feet high, two massive pillars supporting it. And it's the walls are covered in reliefs. And about sort of 12 feet up, perhaps, on this wall, there's what seems to be a sort of skirmish at sea or a skirmish on a river. There's boatmen or sailors in little boats, about three per boat, and they're facing each other, and they're throwing things at each other. They've got spears. Perhaps unusually about this one, though, is that there's a commentary on what's going on.
What is very unique here is the vulgar language that is being used among the sailors right here. Come here, you niku, and the word niku is actually passive participle of a verb nek, which literally means to copulate, to have sex.
He's calling him a faggot.
He is, yeah, he's calling him a faggot, pretty much.
Isn't this strong evidence of the presence of homosexuality as an identity rather than simply a sexual behaviour? Dr. Richard Parkinson of the British Museum.
It isn't about a one-off sexual act. It sounds as if it's more to do with something that is almost inherent in the person.
And in the texts, there's plenty of evidence for same-sex desire in ancient Egypt.
One particular story concerns two rival gods, Horus and Seth, and it records what is probably the first known chat-up line in the whole of human history, and that is between two male gods. Seth wants to sleep with Horus, and so he says to Horus, "How beautiful your backside is." Horus doesn't fancy it and finds a way of slipping away during the night. Another much more informative composition is the tale of King Pepi and his general. And in this, a courtier has heard rumours about the king, what he does during the night, and so follows him. The king goes out at night, he climbs up into the general's house and has sex with him.
And this is not an isolated occurrence.
The general, the characterisation of the general as somebody who has no wife in his house, suggests he's unmarried, which is very unusual in Egyptian society as far as we can tell. And it does suggest it's not just a one-off event. It's something which both men are consenting to, are wanting, and are doing by habit, by character. There is no way you can regard the line, "How beautiful is your backside," as in any way ambiguous. The cultural overtones that were attached to it change, but they probably changed in ancient times. Most people would read a story like that with good heteronormative disapproval, but there must have been plenty of people in ancient Egypt who would read it and recognise something of themselves in that.
So off we go. As I leave Egypt, I'm thinking how careful we need to be not to impose too much of our present on a distant and not so distant past. Same-sex desire in our culture and time is, of course, experienced and expressed differently from other cultures and eras. And besides, in any time or place, what can be more elusive than desire, so intimate and problematic? Nevertheless, I don't think I'm alone in sensing something very familiar in Anne Lister's diaries and an ancient Egyptian general's idea of R&R.
Out in the World is presented by Richard Coles. The series consultant is Professor Bill Nafee, and the producer was Lawrence Grizel. And the second programme in this series is tomorrow evening, in fact, at 10:15, when Richard Coles visits Greece.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, two iconic American works. And two composers from the old world harness the emotive force of the African-American spiritual. Tippett's A Child of Our Time, alongside music by Ives, Zimmerman and Samuel Barber. Tomorrow night at the BBC Proms, starting at 7:30.
Well, that's tomorrow night. Back to tonight. This is BBC Radio 3. The time is now 10:15. And coming up at 11:45, Fiona Torkington introduces Late Junction. But now, from the stage of the Royal Albert Hall in London, here's Lucy Duran with the second of this evening's proms.
Hello and welcome to this late night prom with me, Lucy Duran, and the World Roots Academy. To give you an idea of what the Academy is all about, let me tell you the story of the young artist who's about to come on stage, because it's a wonderful tale of how music plays such an important role in shaping people's identities. He was born in West London to Colombian parents. He had a musical uncle back in Colombia, but otherwise no music in his family. But early on, he fell in love with vallenato, a vibrant oral tradition of accordion music from northeast Colombia, where he'd never even set foot. He was determined to learn to play vallenato, and so his parents bought him an accordion. But with no teachers in London, he had to make do with recordings of the great masters such as Alejo Duran, no relation to me, by the way, and he picked up his techniques by watching YouTube. Enter World Roots Academy, a scheme dreamt up by the BBC Radio 3's World Roots programme to support and promote young talent in this country by putting them together with a mentor from their country of origin. The Academy is in its third year now, and this is our first venture into Latin America. Well, once we'd selected this brilliant young artist, we had to help him realize his dream of competing in the Festival of the Vallenato Legend in Valledupar in northeast Colombia. We're proud to say that he got into the quarterfinals against a very tough competition, thanks to his dedicated mentor, the accordionist Egidio Cuadrado, who will be coming on stage later on with his all-star band of vallenato musicians flown in for this one event, specially from Colombia. So now, picture yourselves on a steamy tropical day in the sleepy town of Valledupar, and if you can, try to imagine that the magnificent Royal Albert Hall organ behind the stage is in fact the majestic snow-covered Sierra Nevada. As we listen to the vallenato in its original trio format of guacharaca scraper, caja drum, and button accordion, please welcome José Hernando, alias Noguera. Thank you.
Yo pensé que un mejoral iba a curarme este gran dolor. Yo pensé que un mejoral iba a curarme este gran dolor. Como si la ausencia fuera remedio para olvidar. Como si la ausencia fuera remedio para olvidar. Yo me fui pa' Venezuela, decepcionado de Valledupar. Yo me fui pa' Venezuela, decepcionado de Valledupar. Como si la ausencia fuera remedio para olvidar. Como si la ausencia fuera remedio para olvidar. Hice un bien, pero me fue muy mal. Hice un mal, pero me fue peor. Hice un bien, pero me fue muy mal. Hice un mal, pero me fue peor. Y ahora no hago bien ni mal, pa' ver si me va mejor. Y ahora no hago bien ni mal, pa' ver si me va mejor. En asunto de mujeres tengo una ley muy bien aprendida. Yo quiero a la que me quiere y olvido a la que me olvida. Yo quiero a la que me quiere y olvido a la que me olvida. Hice un bien pero me fue muy mal. Hice un mal pero me fue peor. Hice un mal pero me fue muy mal. Hice un bien pero me fue peor. Y ahora no hago bien ni mal, va a ver si me va mejor. Y ahora no hago bien ni mal, va a ver si me va mejor.
Via West London, José Hernando Noguera on button accordion, our World Roots Academy protege of 2012. And all the way from La Guajira province up in northeast Colombia, Alfredo Rosado on caja, the drum, and Eder Polo on guacharaca, the scraper. And that was a paseo, one of the four styles of vallenato that we'll be hearing tonight. Now, if you've read your 100 Years of Solitude by the great Colombian writer Gabriel García Márquez, you'll know that in the old days, vallenato musicians roamed from village to village singing the local news. And that troubadour spirit still lives on in this music, which is now famous all over Latin America. One reason why vallenato is such a thriving tradition is because of the Festival of the Vallenato Legend held every year in Valledupar. So popular and so important is this festival that it even gets a visit from the president of Colombia. Well, we took Jose Hernando there a couple of months ago, together with his mentor, a masterful accordionist who won the top title of King of Vallenato at the festival back in 1985. He's from La Guajira in northeast Colombia. That's the real Vallenato territory. And most of the musicians that he's brought with him are also from there. They're going to be playing all four Vallenato styles, paseo, merengue, son, and puya. So please welcome on stage el maestro Egidio Cuadrado.
¿Qué cultura va a tener un indio chumeca como Lorenzo Morales? ¿Qué cultura va a tener si nació en los Cardonales? ¡Ay, qué cultura va a tener si nació en los Cardonales! Morales miente a mi mamá solamente pa' ofender. Morales miente a mi mamá solamente pa' ofender. Que él también se ofenda, ahora le miento la de él. Para que él también se ofenda, ahora le miento la de él. Y me lleva él o me lo llevo yo, pa' que se acabe la vaina. Me lleva él o me lo llevo yo, pa' que se acabe la vaina. Ay, Morales a mí no me lleva, porque no me da la gana. Moralito a mí no me lleva, porque no me da la gana. Moralito, Moralito se creía, hombre que la mí, que la mí me iba a ganar. Y cuando me oyó tocar, le cayó la gota fría. Y cuando me oyó tocar, le cayó la gota fría. Al cabo en la compartía, el tiro le salió mal. Al cabo en la compartía, el tiro le salió mal. Thank you.
no diga de mí que yo la tengo olvidada. También le traigo su regalito, un corte blanco con su collar. También le traigo su regalito, un corte blanco con su collar, para que haga un traje bonito y plequete por el plan. Para que haga un traje bonito y plequete por el plan. Pa' que no diga la vieja Sara que yo solo vine a saludarla. Pa' que no diga la vieja Sara que yo solo vine a saludarla. Pa' ver si me va a repetir lo malo que ha dicho de mí. Pa' ver si me va a repetir lo malo que ha dicho de mí. De Toño Sala y María, vive la mamá de Emiliano, de Toño Sala y María. Un poco viejo me estoy poniendo, será por los años que van pasando. Un poco viejo me estoy poniendo, será por los años que van pasando. Pero yo la quiero y la estimo, porque sigo siendo el mismo. Pero la quiero y la estimo, porque sigo siendo el mismo.
Muy, muy buenas noches. Bueno, quiero llamar al escenario.
This is the maestro Egidio Cuadrado saying hello to the crowd here, the wonderful enthusiastic crowd. Many, you can hear them, many Colombians, obviously. And he has just invited his protege, José Hernando, back onto the stage. So now we have the two accordionists greeting each other. And José Hernando is actually on Egidio's right, so that's left in the stereo picture if you want to pick out the mentor from the protege. And here we go, El Cantor de Fonseca.
Esa parranda, si es tan amable toquenla otra vez, quiero escuchar de nuevo su guitarra. Óigame compa, usted no es del Valle, del Magdalena ni de Bolívar, pues se me antoja que sus cantares son de una tierra desconocida. Y yo le dije, si a usted le inspira saber la tierra de donde soy, con mucho gusto y a mucho honor, yo soy del centro de la Guajira. Frente al mar Caribe, de donde muy pequeño me llevaron. Allá en Barranca me va
bautizaron y en toda la Guajira me hice libre. Yo vi tocar a Santander Martínez, a Bolañito, a Francisco el Hombre, a Lolebrito, al señor Luis Pitre, los acordeones de más renombre. Soy de una tierra grata y honesta, la que su historia lleva mi nombre. Yo soy aquel cantor de Fonseca, la patria hermosa de Chema Gómez. Viví en un pueblo chiquito y bonito, llamado Lagunita de la Sierra, del que conservo recuerdos queridos, emporio de acordeonistas y poetas. Allí toqué con Julio Francisco, con Monche Brito, con Chiche Guerra, y conocí bien a Bienvenido, el que compuso Berta Caldera. Ya me despido, soy Carlos Huerta, doy mi apellido y nombre de pila. Yo soy aquel cantor de Fonseca y soy nativo de La Guajira.
Ay, pobre mi Alicia. te recuerdo en todas mis parrandas.
Pobre mi Alicia, Alicia querida,
yo te recordaré toda la vida.
Solamente pa' que vivas tú. Te voy a hacer una casa en el aire, solamente pa' que vivas tú. Después le pongo un letrero bien grande, con nubes blancas que diga da luz. Después le pongo un letrero bien grande, con nubes blancas que diga da luz. Cuando a la luz sea una señorita y alguno le quiera hablar de amor. Cuando a la luz sea una señorita y alguno le quiera hablar de amor, el tipo tiene que ser aviador para que pueda hacerle una visita. El tipo tiene que ser aviador para que pueda hacerle una visita. Porque el que no vuela no sube
a ver a la luz de la nube.
Porque el que no vuela no llega allá
a ver a la luz de la inmensidad.
Voy a hacer mi casa en el aire
pa' que no la moleste nadie.
Ay, ponte a pensar cómo seré bonito vivir arriba de todo el mundo. Ponte a pensar cómo seré bonito vivir arriba de todo el mundo. Allá en las nubes con los angelitos, sin que te pueda molestar ninguno. Allá en las nubes con los angelitos, sin que te pueda molestar ninguno. Si te preguntan cómo se sube, decirle que muchos se han perdido. Si te preguntan cómo se sube, decirle que muchos se han perdido. Para ir al cielo creo que no hay camino. Nosotros dos iremos en una nube. Para ir al cielo creo que no hay camino. Nosotros dos iremos en una nube. Porque el que no vuela no sube
a ver a la luz en la nube.
Porque el que no vuela no llega ya
a ver a la luz.
Voy a hacer mi casa en el aire
pa' que no la moleste nadie.
This next song coming up is called La Puya Inglesa. Composition by El Maestro Egidio Cuadrado, King Vallenato. And it's based on a boy, a British boy, trying to, you know, make his dream come true. Talks about the festival, El Festival Vallenato, the Festival Vallenato, Legend Vallenato Festival in Colombia. And this is a composition that Maestro Hirio made. And there's a bit of English.